Executive from the Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones out of Leesburg, and writer and political commentator John White out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of Chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna rabbakumu Allahu alladhi khalaqa as-samawati wal-ardha fi sittati ayyam. خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: North Korea says a new U.S. alliance in the Indo-Pacific region and its submarine contract with Australia could trigger a, quote, nuclear arms race. A top U.S. Democratic senator says the U.S. military's drone strike in Afghanistan last month that killed 10 civilians was a human tragedy. Also, the Yemeni army gains control of a strategic area in the central province of Ma'rib in its battle against Saudi-led coalition forces. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. With our top story, the UK and the US are trying to smooth tensions with France after Australia scrapped a submarine order with Paris in favor of a deal with Washington and London. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has rejected a diplomatic rift, saying his country's love of France is ineradicable. US President Joe Biden has also requested a phone call with his French counterpart. A French government spokesman says the U.S. has to answer for what looks a lot like a major breach of trust. Australia scrapped a multi-billion-dollar submarines deal with France and entered a pact to build them with U.S. and British technology. France accuses the U.S. and Australia of lying and duplicity while lashing out at the U.K. for its, quote, permanent opportunism. Paris has already recalled its envoys to Canberra and Washington and canceled a defense meeting with London. North Korea says the new U.S. alliance in the Indo-Pacific region and a submarine contract with Australia could trigger a, quote, nuclear arms race. An official from the country's foreign ministry has called the moves extremely undesirable and dangerous acts, which will upset the strategic balance in the region. The official described the U.S. as the chief culprit disrupting the international nuclear non-proliferation system. The North Korean diplomat noted that the move is widely seen as aimed at countering the rise of China. Geopolitical analyst James O'Neill earlier joined us with his take on Australia's scrapping a submarine deal with France in the backdrop of a new security pact with the US and the UK. Listen.
The whole thing is a total shambles. Australia has cancelled a deal that it had with France to build submarines. It's now entered into a very vague and unspecified contract with the United Kingdom and the United States to build 8 submarines for Australia, the first of which would be at least 10 years away. They do not have enough staff to operate the existing submarines in this country, let alone 8 new, more complicated nuclear submarines that they're talking about. I tend to agree with Scott Ritter's assessment that this is a total farce, and these submarines will never be produced and delivered to Australia. Agreements being made with Australia that have a bigger problem with France, that is, of course, bitterly disappointed at the cancellation of the contract, which will cost Australia some billions of dollars to finally get out of.
U.S. Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders has criticized as unacceptable a drone strike in Afghanistan last month that killed civilians. Sanders made the comment in an interview with CBS. He called the attack a human tragedy. The Vermont senator said the Biden administration must reassure that such incidents never happen again. U.S. officials admitted last week that 10 civilians, including 7 children, were among the fatalities of Washington's strike in the Afghan capital. On August the 29th, before its withdrawal, the U.S. military carried out a drone strike to target an alleged Daesh K terrorist bomber in Kabul. But now Washington says investigations show the strike has been a mistake and that the targeted vehicle had not been associated with the terrorists. On September 20th, 2011, Press TV cameraman in Afghanistan, Sayed Farhad Taqaddusi, was killed during a Taliban attack in Kabul. On the 10th anniversary of the incident, our Kabul correspondent Amin Alemi has filed a report.
In 2007, when Press TV began to operate in Afghanistan with a small but well-experienced team who are still working round the clock. They have done their best to be the voice of voiceless people in Afghanistan and even sacrificed their lives to shed light on the realities in this war-torn country. For instance, Press TV has lost 2 of its base cameramen in separate Taliban and Daesh attacks so far, and September coincides with the martyrdom anniversary of one of them. Late Sayed Farhad Taqaddusi. Following the martyrdom of Sayed Farhad, Press TV hired his younger brother, Sayed Najib Taqaddusi, who himself was working as a cameraman and editor in one of Afghanistan's leading news channels. Najib says, although it is impossible to forget the shock and pain of the loss of his brother, he is committed to following his path as a frontline soldier of press freedom in Afghanistan.
Farhad was very lovely. He was a responsible and hard-working man. His main goal was to turn Afghanistan into a better place for Afghans by promoting press freedom and making the voice of the voiceless heard. Of course, I will pursue the same goal.
Sayed Mujtaba Taqaddusi is Farhad's uncle. In his eyes, the loss of Farhad was a huge blow to his entire family, friends and colleagues. But what makes his loss bearable is that he lost his life for the sake of a free and independent Afghanistan where all voices can be heard.
I personally cannot accept that Farhad is no more among us. His memory is with us and we keep his ideals and goals alive. He was a true servant of the oppressed Afghan people.
It was on September 20, 2011, when a group of armed Taliban militants captured a high-rise building in a heavily protected area of Kabul and began hitting different targets with rockets and mortar shells. One of those rockets hit Press TV office in Wazir Akbar Khan area, which killed Sayed Farhad Taqaddusi. He was later led to rest in Western Kabul, and a high number of people attended his funeral ceremony. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Our hearts go out to his family and friends. May he rest in peace. The Yemeni army has seized control of the strategic Wadi Nakhla area in the country's central province of Ma'rib. the army has engaged in fierce clashes with troops affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda elements there. Abdul Latif al-Washili joined us earlier with more details.
The Yemeni army is determined to liberate the whole Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and also the terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. The Yemeni army captured and liberated Wadi Nakhla area following intense clashes with the elements of Al-Qaeda and also the Saudi-backed forces. This area lies northwest of the capital of Marib. It is a new victory for the Yemeni army after liberating 1,600 kilometers, square kilometers, including Madghal and also Majzar Directorate. Mass camp was also captured by the Yemeni army, backed by local tribes. This camp is considered one of the largest camps used by the Saudi coalition during the past years. So the Yemeni army continues advancing toward the city and is proving that it is really determined and serious about liberating the city of Marib from the foreign presence.
Muslims are descending on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arba'een. The pilgrims are marching on the shrine city to join the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The occasion this year falls on September the 28th. The Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors due to the coronavirus pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler at the time over 13 centuries ago. The battle, known as the Ashura event, is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. Moving on, Palestinian political activist and scholar Hanan Ashrawi says the recent prison break by a number of detainees showed even Israel's most secure jails are incapable of limiting their freedom.
These are Palestinians unjustly imprisoned in many cases and unlawfully kept within prisons in Israel and judged by a military court of the occupation. So, and kept in one of the most secure prisons in Israel, Gilboa, and they managed persistently and in an amazing way to dig this tunnel, to be able to find their way to freedom. It gave the Palestinians a sense of hope, a boost of morale, that even Israel's most militarily secured location is not immune to the Palestinian spirit and yearning to be free.
Ashrawi said all Palestinians are united in defending and supporting the inmates who managed to escape from the Israeli prison. She noted that people across Palestine show solidarity with the prisoners because their land has been held captive by the Israeli regime. The former Palestinian official said the prison break is also an indication that the detainees are totally committed to their freedom.
The issue is that there is this dedication, there is this total commitment to achieving their freedom, to seeing their families, to, as one person said, 5 days smelling the fresh air of Palestine, of looking at Palestine, of eating some of the fruits and so on, is equal to a lifetime in prison. This is the kind of spirit, undefeated spirit, of the Palestinian people. It's the air return.
Ashrawi further said Israel's attempt to diminish such achievements is typical and the regime has been doing so for decades. She added that Tel Aviv has been trying to distort and undermine Palestinian struggle as a whole, including that of the freedom fighters in Palestine. Ashrawi stressed that the regime in Tel Aviv uses every possible means, including utter lawlessness, against the captive population of Palestine. The activist also called on the Israeli regime to liberate all Palestinians from its jails. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally to voice their support for the rearrested inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail 2 weeks ago. They also called on the international bodies not to remain silent in the face of the basic rights violations of Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails. Ruba Shabat reports from Gaza.
The rearrest of the last two remaining Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail has sparked public outrage among the Palestinians. Palestinians have come together in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at Israel's growing pressure on the Palestinian inmates.
We in the Gaza Strip stress that fight against the Israeli occupation will go on and the rearrest of the inmates won't deter us from expressing our solidarity with them. The prison break of the Palestinian inmates has inflicted a heavy blow on Israel's image. The resistance front has vowed to set them free in the coming exchange deal. We will never forget this achievement.
Reports say the two men were caught alive in Jenin, their hometown in the West Bank, after they were surrounded by Israeli army.
We have come here to condemn the inhumane Israeli treatment of our prisoners. Our message to our inmates is that we will keep supporting them until they are freed. The international community has ignored the issue of Palestinian prisoners for years.
2 weeks ago, six Palestinian inmates caved through a dug hole in the floor of their shared cell, exposing deep security flaws of the Israeli system. Palestinians held several rallies calling for ending the Israeli violation of prisoners' rights.
Palestinians will keep holding events like this to voice their support to our detainees in Israeli jails. Israeli regime should know that our prisoners are not alone and we view them as symbol of resistance. The international community should break its silence and expose the true nature of Israeli regime.
Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them under the practice of administrative detention.
Palestinians here stress the rearresting of two inmates who broke out of the Jabu prison does not hide the fragility of the Israeli security system. Palestinians see the escape as a remarkable incident in the history of the Palestinian cause, demanding the international community to stop Israel's torture against detainees. Ruba Shabat, Gaza.
Russia's ruling party is on course to retain a majority in the country's parliamentary elections. With 33% of ballots counted, the Central Election Commission said the United Russia Party that supports President Vladimir Putin has received over 45% of the vote. Its main rival, the Communist Party, is in the second place with around 22% of the ballots. In the last parliamentary elections in 2016, United Russia won just over 54% of the vote. The party currently holds two-thirds majority in the parliament. A volcano has erupted on the Spanish Canary island of La Palma, sending jets of lava and a plume of smoke and ash into the air. Authorities had begun evacuating people and farm animals from the surrounding villages before the eruption. Immediately after the eruption, the municipality urged residents in a statement to, quote, exercise extreme caution. Experts said they couldn't be sure how long the eruption would last. La Palma has been on high alert since 1971 due to a major eruption, and it is one of the most active volcanic regions in the Canaries. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of World News. Thank you for staying through.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
in the limelight.
Peace and human rights advocates accused President Joe Biden of breaking his promise to end American support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen after the U.S. State Department approved a potential agreement to provide $500 million worth of support services to the West Asian monarchy known for its pervasive human rights abuses and military atrocities. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Anti-War Voices Blast Biden Over Absurd $500 Million Saudi Military Contract. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Peace and human rights advocates recently accused President Joe Biden of breaking his promise to end American support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen after the U.S. State Department approved a potential agreement to provide $500 million worth of support services to the West Asian monarchy, known for its pervasive human rights abuses and military atrocities. In a statement, the U.S. State Department said recently that the proposed $500 million maintenance support services contract, which will serve the Saudi military's fleet of AH-64DE, UH-60L, UH-60M, Schweizer-333 and Bell-406 CS helicopters, as well as the new CH-47F Chinook copters, it is slated to acquire, will support U.S. foreign policy and national security objectives by helping to improve the security of a friendly country that continues to be an important force for political stability and economic growth in the Middle East, unquote. Reuters reports the proposal is the first major military deal involving Saudi Arabia sent to Congress since Biden took office. In February, Common Dreams reported that the president announced an end to U.S. support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Peace campaigners hailed the move as they did the administration's earlier decision imposing a temporary freeze on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, pending a review of billions of dollars worth of weapons deals with the repressive regimes that were approved during the tenure of former President Donald Trump. Anti-war and human rights activists decried the new proposed contract as a betrayal of Biden's pledge to end American backing of a war that has claimed more than 200,000 Yemeni lives. This breaks the Biden administration's promise to end U.S. support for the tragic war in Yemen, tweeted Peace Action Executive Director John Rainwater, who added that it is pretty tone-deaf for State Department to call Saudi Arabia a friendly country. He asked, friendly to whom? Not Yemeni civilians or Saudi women. Jeff Abramson, Senior Fellow for Conventional Arms Control and Transfers at Washington, D.C.-based Arms Control Association, tweeted that if the United States is serious about ending the blockade of Yemen and do not provide offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia, it certainly is not using its leverage when it plans a $500 million agreement to continue service of Saudi helicopters. Eric Sperling, Executive Director of D.C.-based advocacy group just foreign policy, tweeted a thread of reports chronicling atrocities committed with helicopters during the Saudi-led war. These include the killing of dozens of Yemeni fishers in a 2015 attack, an Apache helicopter strike on a boat full of Somali refugees that killed at least 40 people in 2017, and a double-tap airstrike that killed 30 civilians, including first responders, in 2015. Saudi Arabia's war crimes in Yemen, its monarchy's support for international terrorism, and its horrific human rights record have prompted calls from across the U.S. political spectrum for a re-evaluation of relations with the oil-rich and geostrategically important ally.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The subcontinent.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at how the collapse of the US-backed government in Kabul and the return of Taliban is likely to affect two key regional players, India and Pakistan. And we shall discuss the never-ending tussle between New Delhi and Islamabad over influence in Afghanistan and the changing regional dynamics.
In the wake of dramatic turn of events in Afghanistan and Taliban's stunning comeback after 20 years, regional powers are jostling to protect their interests in the strategically important country. Recalibrating strategies in line with the new reality seems to be the way forward. For the past 20 years, the two South Asian strange neighbors, India and Pakistan, vied for influence in Afghanistan. While India invested heavily in infrastructure projects using its soft power, Pakistan was accused of harnessing the Taliban as its proxy.
The strategic location of Afghanistan, lying at the crossroads of Central Asia and South Asia, has enticed many powerful empires over the centuries. It has also drawn many regional powers towards it. India and Pakistan, the arch rivals who have fought three wars, being the two leading protagonists. These two countries have always had presence in the landlocked country, but since the US invasion in 2001, their footprints increased considerably, albeit in remarkably different ways, to the point that many regional observers accused them of engaging in a proxy war. While keeping its military out of the war-ravaged country, India invested in key infrastructure projects since 2001, to the tune of $3 billion, from the strategic Zaranj-Dilaram Highway in Nimruz, Salmor Dam in Herat, new parliament building in Kabul and a cricket stadium in Kandahar, the use of soft power significantly bolstered ties between New Delhi and the US-backed governments in Kabul. On the other hand, Pakistan remained at loggerheads with the successive governments in Kabul, who accused Islamabad of providing sanctuary to Taliban leaders and using the group as its proxy. Pakistan, nevertheless, remained a key player in Afghanistan and played an instrumental role in facilitating Afghan-led talks in Doha due to its leverage over the Taliban.
When Taliban took over Afghanistan in the 90s, there were three countries which accepted a Taliban government: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and UAE. None of other countries accepted it. So Taliban became a very isolated and a poor country, and the difference of opinion continued. And all the people who are opposed to Taliban from Afghanistan took refuge in India. Abdullah Abdullah, Hamid Karzai, and all of them. When 9/11 happened, these people were put in the power after throwing out Taliban. So Pakistan is in a very positive and important strategical ally of Taliban from the first day. They trained them, they harbored them, they even financed them. So I think it is very important to understand this historic background, and now Pakistan is quite happy with Taliban taking over again.
With the US installed government in Kabul out of the picture and the ragtag group of fighters announcing their return with a proverbial bang, many believe the emerging situation favors Pakistan and represents a setback to India, which made massive investments over the last 20 years. While Pakistan has already started engagements with Taliban's interim government, India is also beginning to soften its stand towards the group it never recognized. New Delhi has come to realize that cold shouldering it this time would only boost Islamabad's leverage over the group.
Barely hours after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August 15th, completing their astonishingly rapid advance across the country, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan was among the first to endorse it. He termed Taliban takeover as breaking the chains of slavery.
جب آپ ذہنی غلام بنتے ہیں تو یہ یاد رکھیں اصل غلامی سے زیادہ بری ذہنی غلامی ذہنی غلامی کی زنجیریں توڑنا زیادہ مشکل ہوتا ہے جو ابھی افغانستان میں غلامی کی زنجیریں تو توڑ دی انہوں نے.
The statement not only illustrated Islamabad's intimately complex relationship with the Taliban, but also revealed its pent-up frustration at the successive governments in Kabul and their Western patrons. The last 20 years since the American invasion in 2001, relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan were marked by deep acrimony. But that might as well change now, with a friendlier government in Kabul. Pakistan was one of the few countries to recognize the Taliban rule in late 1990s, and it played host to Taliban's top leadership since 2001. The goal primarily was to contain Pashtun nationalism at home and counter India's growing influence in its neighborhood.
Since occupation of Afghanistan by the Western forces led by NATO and USA, they relied much more on India, because all the president and leaders who were put in power in Afghanistan were either supporter of India or have lived during the last struggle in India, Abdullah Abdullah, Hamid Karzai, and everybody. Now, Western world were not relying on Pakistan because they thought, the Western world, that Pakistan is playing double game. While he's supporting the Western countries in after 9/11 to destroy the Taliban, at the same time, they are supporting Taliban because all the Taliban leadership was still either in Pakistan or was living in the areas where Pakistan has influence.
India, which always considered Taliban a terrorist group, has lately been holding talks with the senior Taliban leadership, which points to growing realization in New Delhi that engaging with the group is critical to protecting its strategic interests in Afghanistan and countering Pakistan's influence and leverage over Taliban. While Islamabad clearly seems to have an upper hand at the moment, recent statements from Taliban officials suggest the window is not entirely closed for New Delhi.
The shadow of India-Pakistan proxy war, driven by competing interests, has always hung like a sword of Damocles over Afghanistan. From the Soviet invasion in the 1980s to Taliban's rule in the 1990s, when the two countries found themselves at the opposite sides of the spectrum. The proxy war was again on display recently, when Pakistan was seen backing the Taliban in the fight for Panjshir Valley, and India went out of its way to support anti-Taliban forces.
Panjshir, the picturesque Hindu Kush Valley in northern Afghanistan, had always been the bastion of anti-Taliban resistance. But earlier this month, Taliban managed to breach the valley's steep, rugged terrain. Ahmed Massoud, the son of legendary anti-Taliban commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, blamed it on foreign mercenaries. The salvo obviously was aimed at Pakistan. Some reports quoted officials in Panjshir saying that Pakistani military had bombed the valley with drones in support of the Taliban. What set tongues wagging was the whirlwind visit of Pakistan spy chief Faiz Hamid to Kabul to meet senior Taliban leaders like Mullah Baradar. The astonishing claims, which could not be substantiated with irrefutable evidence, were amplified by the Indian media. Babar Iftikhar, a spokesman for Pakistani army, termed it a malicious propaganda by India, while Pakistan's national security advisor Moeed Yusuf linked the accusations to a fake news network created by India. The din of claims and counterclaims only brought to light the long and murky proxy war between the two arch rivals, which has manifested itself in Afghanistan in recent years. The former Pakistani military ruler Parvez Musharraf warned about it back in 2014, when he admitted that the danger for Pakistan is the Indian influence in Afghanistan.
While it's true that the new political dispensation in Kabul presents advantages to Islamabad in terms of regional power play and the ability to influence political developments in the country, there are some legitimate concerns as well, which have accentuated in recent days. It's the same case with India as well. Despite New Delhi's recent overtures to Taliban and the group's assurance that there would be no anti-India activity in Afghanistan, there is growing fear that Taliban's resurgence could pave the way for the growth of anti-India militant outfits.
Despite Pakistan sharing a unique relationship with Taliban, the Imran Khan government is not entirely relaxed about the group's takeover in Afghanistan. The issue of Durand Line, a de facto fence between the two countries, remains a bone of contention. Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid's recent comments on the issue have caused jitters in Pakistan. Another issue is about Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan. Pakistani governments have for long claimed that top commanders of the militant group operate from the Afghan soil, while Pakistan expects Taliban to act against them. The group believes the issue needs to be dealt with by Pakistan. Pertinently, in the chaos that followed Taliban takeover recently, hundreds of TTP fighters were released from Afghan jails. Afghan refugee crisis is also likely to determine the course of Taliban-Pakistan relations. The country, which already hosts around 3 million Afghan refugees, has refused to register newcomers. India has its own concerns about Taliban's triumphant return. The group had traditionally close ties with anti-India militant outfits like Lashkar-e-Toiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed that operate from Pakistan. Haqqani Network, which is the part of Taliban, was allegedly behind the bombing of Indian embassy in Kabul. And New Delhi fears Taliban's comeback might affect security situation in Indian-controlled Kashmir. India's concerns also stem from Taliban's close ties with Pakistan and China, two formidable regional rivals of India. With American exit, China's involvement in the country is likely to increase, which will further undercut India's interests and influence in the country.
We've spent so long, 20 years, for, you know, and we haven't really helped anybody. We haven't really helped the Afghan people either. They've just been left to suffer, really.
Absolute disaster. Absolute mess. Shambles. And Rab should be kicked out on his backside.
We seem to be the country that is first in line to get involved with these things. We're a really small country, you know.
Over a year to get everybody out. We had over a year to plan, and I know we've trained Afghanistan troops, but it just didn't work out the way we planned at all.
If America had the parliamentary system that we do over in Britain, I think that they'd be looking at having a new president.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Saeed Khan, Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Khan. Sir, India and Pakistan have for years vied for influence in the strategically located Afghanistan. So how are the recent turn of events and Taliban's return likely to impact them?
Afghanistan has in many ways become a venue for a proxy battle between India and Pakistan for regional leverage over one another. And again, this plays into a rather tragic history that Afghanistan has endured, not only for the last few decades, but also for the last several centuries, when superpowers like first the Russian Empire, then the Soviet Union, and of course Great Britain, have vied for dominance over one another, but at the expense of Afghanistan. More recently, what we find is that India and Pakistan have entered into this fray. Of course, Pakistan is a neighbor. It is adjacent to Afghanistan, whereas India is not. And Pakistan has had, in recent times, a far longer history of engagement with Afghanistan, dating back to the Soviet invasion from 1979 to 1989, something that has been very costly for Pakistan economically, politically, diplomatically, as well as reputationally on the world stage. India, over the last several years, has sought to play a disruptive role in Afghanistan, not necessarily for the benefit of the Afghans, but really as a way to antagonize Pakistan. Now, the return of the Taliban and the removal of essentially India's quasi-client in Kabul, more recently Ashraf Ghani, is going to have a major change in the geopolitics of the region. Pakistan is definitely going to benefit immensely, and really at India's expense.
Now, for the past 20 years, India earned goodwill from investments in Afghanistan, while Pakistan earned wrath for backing Taliban. Now, do you think the situation now favors Pakistan?
Over the last several years, India had established a various series of arrangements with the Kabul regime, including the establishment of over a dozen consulates. Now, for the kind of trade, commercial, and tourist engagement that one would expect, the increase of that many consulates to be the reality between Afghanistan and India is really hard to fathom. Instead, as has long been suspected, the establishment of those consulates was essentially creating institutions and platforms for India's security service, the RAW, particularly in its engagement at cross-border conflict with Pakistan. Now that the Taliban are back in power, those consulates are gone. as well as by and large leverage that New Delhi might have with the Taliban regime. The Taliban, on the other hand, have a series of new patrons in the area, far more than their situation in the 1990s. Remember, back then there were only three countries that recognized formally the Taliban government: Pakistan, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Now, there are several players that are, if not immediately recognizing the Taliban regime, certainly negotiating with them at a very high level. And this includes two superpowers and members of the UN Security Council, Russia and China. We still have Pakistan, but we also have some other players.
And now, let's take a break and take a look at how the global media has covered the India-Pakistan rivalry in the strategically located Afghanistan, and what impact will the changed equations under Taliban have on the two countries.
The Taliban's swift takeover has brought to power an Afghan government more closely aligned with Pakistan, stirring security concerns in neighboring India and potentially raising tensions between the two nuclear-armed rivals. Officials in India, who supported the US-backed government in Kabul, have warned in recent days that the Taliban's return could again make the country a hot terrorist. The Taliban have said they would no longer allow Afghanistan to be used against other countries, but India officials are skeptical. India has a lot more to offer economically than it built up two decades of goodwill as one of the biggest investors in development, spending over $3 billion, £2.2 billion, to build schools, colleges, hospitals, electricity grids, dams and a parliament building, something Pakistan has never had the resources to do. The Taliban have made it clear they want India's projects to continue. Beyond the regional arena of the India, Pakistan and Afghanistan triangle and the proxy war that Indians and Pakistanis have been waging in Afghanistan for at least half a century, the return of the Taliban could affect other global balances. The relationship between India and the United States could be altered by this new situation.
So India has always considered Taliban a militant group even when it was ruling Afghanistan in the late 1990s. But now we are seeing talks between the two sides. Now my question is, has India acknowledged Taliban as a political reality?
India has always invoked the issue of the Taliban as being a potential problem to various extremist groups or liberation groups operating within Kashmir and elsewhere within India. As a result of it, New Delhi has used that as their justification for isolating, alienating, and even collaborating with the former Kabul regimes of Ashraf Ghani and Hamid Karzai as a way to try to temper and neutralize the Taliban influence within Afghanistan, as well as the fact of their knowledge that the Taliban and Pakistan's ISI share very close ties. Whether or not that is seen as an act of pragmatism that India now recognizes the Taliban as being the reality within Afghanistan remains to be seen. But I think what's really changed is that the kinds of dealings that India is now conducting with factions of the Taliban, not necessarily with the full regime that is currently in control of the country, but splinters.
I also wanted to ask you about the Panjshir conflict. Now, Pakistan was accused of backing Taliban, while India was accused of supporting anti-Taliban forces. Now, do you see it as part of their proxy war in Afghanistan?
Given the fact that there are still several external entities that want to support, prop up the resistance, or the so-called resistance of the Northern Alliance, which is based in Panjshir province, it is not a surprise that India will try to, at the very least, demonstrate diplomatic support for Ahmed Massoud and the Northern Alliance resistance there, but also provide logistical support as well. And we've seen this with other pretenders to the great game in Afghanistan, or at least this incarnation, including French President Emmanuel Macron, who is and has been seen as meeting with Ahmed Massoud. Now, in the case of France, there's two reasons for this. One is they seem to enjoy and relish maintaining some kind of colonialistic, imperialistic view when it comes to the world stage. And also Macron, it seems, is trying to assert his bona fides as a strong leader, as an internationalist, because of the upcoming elections in France next year. He wants to try to distinguish himself, particularly with the departure of Angela Merkel as the Chancellor of Germany, repositioning France as the alleged dominant force within the European Union. It's unlikely that that is really going to yield the success metrics that Macron is seeking, particularly when it comes to his own political survival within the country. But it does indicate that there is still a defiance, a resistance of many to acknowledge the reality of the Taliban being the overwhelming force within the country. It remains to be seen again how successful they will be.
Mr. Khan, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. We're glad to have you here on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media on India and Pakistan weighing up their options in Afghanistan in the wake of Taliban's comeback.
Indian academic and commentator Ashok Swain says West had to choose between India and Pakistan in Afghanistan, pointing to their competing interests. Moeed Yusuf, Pakistan's national security advisor, calls Indian media fake news industry and says it duped world in blaming Pakistan for Afghanistan's internal failures. New Delhi-based strategic thinker and author Brahma Chelani accuses Pakistan of interference in Afghanistan, citing reports about Panjshir attacks and ISI chief's visit to Kabul. Michael Kugelman, a noted South Asia analyst, says Pakistan's relationship with Taliban is likely to change as the group is now running a country instead of fighting a war. Kabul-based university lecturer Harun Rahimi urges both India and Pakistan to cooperate in Afghanistan rather than competing and creating proxies.
And that was our episode on the never-ending rivalry of two South Asian strange neighbors, India and Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and how Taliban's return is likely to affect their equations. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight.
Whoever succeeds in meting out justice to the dastardly Trump would be doing a great favor to humanity and humanitarian causes, says Kayhan International staff in an article published under the heading Yemen's Resolve to Bring Trump to Justice. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There's some heartening reports from Saudi-aggressed Yemen. Despite the bid of the nefarious U.S. regime to prolong the unwarranted war by supplying Riyadh with more lethal weapons to kill civilians and destroy the infrastructure of the Arab world's most impoverished country. The first is the liberation of a large area of 1,600 square kilometers around the soon-to-be-liberated city of Mareb, in the oil-rich province of the same name, and capture of some 550 mercenaries as the rest of the Saudi UAE-backed forces fled with their 12,400 wounded after suffering 3,000 dead in the several weeks-long Operation Intense Strength, in addition to the loss of as many as 1,500 military vehicles. The second gratifying news is the justice meted out by the government in Sana'a to a bunch of U.S.-Saudi-backed traders involved in the assassination in 2018 of the then President Saleh Assemad, with nine of them executed at Tahrir Square, and some others sentenced to death in absentia after trial, including the former U.S. President Donald Trump and heir apparent Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia regime. It was not disclosed how the authorities of Yemen would track down the heavily guarded American and Saudi officials to implement the verdict against them. If they succeed, it would certainly be a very significant step in international justice against the state actors of terrorism, especially in view of the fact that criminal Trump is wanted in several countries in many other cases, murder and destruction. Whoever succeeds in meting out justice to the dastardly Donald Trump would be doing a great favor to humanity and humanitarian causes. The war in Yemen, which is now in its sixth year, is indeed a tragedy of the modern world and an undeniable proof of the criminal terrorist nature of the U.S. regime and its clients. It would have ended in its first year if the American regime would